Iran's foreign minister calls on his country's neighbors to cooperate in achieving common interests following Donald Trump's defeat in the U.S. presidential election. Nearly a dozen people, including several civilians, are killed in a Daesh attack on an Iraqi army checkpoint west of Baghdad. Also coming up, the Israeli cabinet approves the construction of a new settlement near the Gaza Strip despite international outcry. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister has called on the country's neighbors to cooperate in achieving common interests following Donald Trump's defeat in the U.S. presidential election. In a tweet in Arabic, Mohammad Javad Zarif stated that, quote, betting on foreigners does not bring security and disappoints. Zarif described dialogue as the only way to end differences and tensions. Iran's top diplomat called on regional countries to build a better future together. Tehran has time and again reiterated its adherence to good neighborly relations with the countries in the region. It has also expressed willingness to engage in negotiation to bridge the existing gaps with its neighbors. Political commentator David Yerubian says given Trump's election loss, West Asian nations now have an opportunity to move away from tension.
I think now we have an opportunity to move away from the conflict and tension that has really characterized especially the last year, but really the last several years, particularly difficult under the Trump regime. And so I believe Zarif's speech is putting forward the call once again for regional dialogue and expressing one of his primary points that security cannot be purchased from outside. It is going to be the indigenous peoples of the world where they exist and their neighbors who are ultimately going to have to deal with one another when the United States empire is no longer there to stir the pot and to purposefully direct and guide nations to work against each other's interests and in the interests of the United States. That President Trump himself has referred to the Saudis and Gulf states essentially as a milk cow, a cow to be milked by the United States and its military industrial complex, and yet leaving them essentially without the ability to defend their own territory. And so hopefully they will take into account especially the last several years of their relationship with the United States and the massive disrespect as well as the losses to their own economies and to their own peoples through the purchase of billions of dollars of arms that are not going to suit their security or their economic interests.
11 people have been killed in a Daesh attack on an Iraqi army checkpoint manned by members of the Popular Mobilization Units west of the country's capital, Baghdad. Security sources and medics say Daesh attacked the monitoring tower, killing 5 members of the Iraqi armed forces. 6 local civilians who had come to help repel the attack also lost their lives during the clashes. The terrorists attacked the watchtower with hand grenades and light weapons. There have been no reports on Daesh's casualties so far. Iraq declared victory over the terrorist group on December 2017, but remnants of the group continue to stage sporadic attacks across the country. 4 U.S. soldiers have reportedly been killed in Syria's eastern city of Deir ez-Zor after their vehicle was targeted with an explosive device. A U.S. military official later refuted the report. Earlier, we were joined by our Damascus correspondent to get the latest on the incident.
According to Syrian state news agency Sana, 4 U.S. soldiers, including a translator, have been killed in an explosive device blast that targeted their vehicle as it was patrolling an area between Al-Hasakeh and Deir ez-Zor governorate. Now, there is still no claim of responsibility of who is behind such an attack, but what happened after that was that U.S. troops over there set a security line around the area of attack and transported the bodies of the killed U.S. soldiers to its illegal base in Al-Shaddadi area. This while there were also, according to locals there in that area, there was U.S. helicopters flying over the area where the attack happened. The attack happened between the both governorates, Al-Hasakeh and their resort, also between two points that U.S. troops usually patrol, which are the Al-Shaddad, the illegal base, U.S. base, and also Al-Umar oil field, both occupied by U.S. troops over there. And we have been always seeing U.S. troops patrolling various parts of northern and northeastern Syria. However, this is the first time that we hear about four U.S. soldiers, that number killed in an attack. Reports suggest that it could be Daesh, because there are still Daesh sleeper cells.
The Israeli cabinet has approved plans for the construction of hundreds of new settlement units near the besieged Gaza Strip. Israeli media said nearly $300,000 will be allocated for building 500 settlement units and developing infrastructure there. The plans come after the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Sudan signed normalization deals with Israel. Israeli settlements are illegal under international law and have been condemned almost unanimously by the international community. Political activist Rabbi David Feldman says Israel's construction of settler units in the occupied territories is not only a violation of international law, but is also against the Jewish principles.
Well, this, unfortunately, this is not the first time this is happening. Well, we all know that this is a crime against humanity. It's a crime against the people living there, people that lived there way before the Zionist movement ever came up to Palestine. This is a crime in international law and is a true violation of Jewish law. Now, these people claim to be the representation of the Jewish people and the representation of Judaism as a whole. We need to understand that none of these actions taken by the State of Israel against anyone, none of these actions are approved by Judaism, by the Jewish religion. This is not only a violation of Judaism, this is not only a violation of international law. This, unfortunately, is causing this terrible conflict that we experience today. It's already for decades that this conflict is going on, but if you go back before then, Jews and Arabs lived in Palestine in peace. This was, unfortunately, interrupted, and unfortunately, this conflict began by this national movement of Zionism, which does not represent the Jewish people or the Jewish religion.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. Observers see the congratulation as an indication that he will drop his now nearly three-year political boycott of the White House. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the West Bank view U.S. President Donald Trump's era as a nightmare, depriving them of their basic rights. Mona Kandil reports from the occupied West Bank.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. In a statement, Abbas said he looks forward to working with the president-elect and his administration. Palestinian officials have expressed their satisfaction with the departure of outgoing President Donald Trump and said, for them, nothing was worse than Trump's era.
We welcome the results of the American elections. Like many world states, we agree that Trump's era was a nightmare. As President Abbas said, we are looking forward to achieve freedom, independence, justice, and dignity for our people. All previous U.S. administrations had specific commitments towards Israel, but this time we hope we can cooperate with the new administration.
Several Palestinian political groups have also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump. The man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there, and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden. But at the same time, he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level. For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has taken the first steps of a transition plan into the White House despite Donald Trump refusing to concede Biden and Vice President-elect. Kamala Harris launched a transition website that lists for their four priorities of COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. The transition website says Biden is assembling a team to tackle the challenges on day one when he formally becomes president. Meanwhile, Trump repeated he would file a string of lawsuits to challenge the results of the election. He said the election was marred by vote fraud and meddling in swing states. Trump also lambasted the mainstream media for projecting that Biden has won the presidency. To discuss the U.S. election and the fallout further, we're joined by Cindy Sheehan, an alternative political activist, and also Christina Tobin, the founder of Free and Equal Elections Foundation. Welcome. Cindy, firstly, when you look at the number of votes each candidate received, are you surprised at how polarized the U.S. has become?
Actually, I'm not. I'm getting some bad feedback in my headphones. Oh, there we go. No, actually, I'm not. I think that this basically happens every election. You know, we know here in the United States, only about half of the people who are eligible to vote do vote. And then each candidate gets about a little over half or a little under half of the vote. So I'm not surprised at all about by this. And I just want to say I wasn't for Trump, certainly not for Biden. And my son was killed in Iraq, and Biden was one of the driving forces of getting the U.S. involved in that illegal, immoral, and completely demented and wrong war. And so I'm not a fan of either one of the candidates, but for the mainstream media to declare a winner when the Electoral College hasn't declared a winner, I think Biden's talk of transition is extremely premature, but I know he's been working on his team since even before he had the Democrat nomination for their presidential candidate. So I know that they do this. I know that there's a lot of rhetoric. And if I were Trump, or if I were advising Trump, I certainly wouldn't concede the election either. There is a lot of evidence of voter fraud, as there is always in almost every U.S. election. But this reminds me of 2000, when the noted war criminal George Bush stole that election.
Christina, some have said that Biden won the election not because he's Joe Biden, but because many wanted to see an end to President Trump and his policies. A protest vote, if you like. Is that something you would go along with?
Well, I do agree with everything Cindy Sheehan just said, and I'm not sure if I got the full question there because it cut out, but again... But electoral fraud is really where the issue is. I think it's really shame on Biden, shame on Bush for coming out announcing Biden as a winner, shame on all the mainstream Murdoch-owned media for announcing Biden as a winner. Cindy is right. It's not determined. This is not the first cycle we've had clear election fraud. Many could argue, and rightfully so, that the election was stolen from Bernie Sanders. The election was stolen from Dr. Ron Paul. And both those individuals feel that way, and I think that they're right. So good on Trump. Like Cindy, I haven't personally voted for a presidential candidate yet, or she doesn't support either one. I haven't voted for one yet. I hope to in the future, in 24 or 28, independent presidential candidate, because the two-party system is just it's two big corporations that are controlling our country here in the U.S. of A, and really a bully to many other countries, and particularly the Palestinians, for sure, and Gaza, and so on. So, yeah, there's a lot of election fraud going on here. George Soros and his power behind the scenes of how many voters' identification cards and mail-in ballots. And so I'm glad that Trump is suing quite a few states. And, yes, I don't think that there has been a winner rightfully determined as of yet in the United States for president.
Right. And, Cindy, do you perhaps foresee a new political landscape in the U.S. under Biden, Washington perhaps returning to international agreements, the Paris climate change, etc.?
Well, you know, despite if they do return to the climate change agreement, or whatever, you'll notice that in the top four things of his transition, nothing is about ending U.S. wars, U.S. imperialism. I understand that Trump was very bad on Iran. I know that I think it was last year that I was on your show and other shows from Iran, and we were mourning the assassination of your general Soleimani. So I know Trump hasn't been good in many ways, and he's increased sanctions on countries all over the world. But one thing that the Biden transition team is not going to work on is ending U.S. imperialism, stopping the wars. Joe Biden was in office for 47 years. Okay, so he's a contributor to the problems that are wreaking havoc on America today. He is not for a Green New Deal. He is not for universal health care. He is not for forgiving student loans or making college easy and accessible for all of our young people. He's part of the establishment. He's part of the problem. And if one can really be honest about it, the 8 years of Biden and Obama, where they took three wars of the Bush administration, expanded them to eight, and also increased sanctions and terrorism around the world, U.S. Terrorism. You know, he is part of the problem. And so in 2016, I didn't vote for Clinton. I didn't vote for Trump. I always vote for a third party. I always vote for a candidate who closely aligns with my principles. But one can argue that by 2016, people were so tired of business as usual in Washington, D.C., they didn't elect Hillary Clinton because she is seen as part of the problem. So I don't understand why someone who was in office for 47 years, who has many, many personal issues and many scandals that the social media and the corporate media didn't report on, Biden's scandals and his son's scandals, and contributing to misery all over the world. So, you know, I think it's just a return to business as usual. You know, it's the same old. And I just, want to close with that whoever gets up to the Democrat or Republican nomination in our country, and I'm not being cynical, I'm being realistic, and I'm looking back, you know, at many decades of electoral analysis, is that whoever reaches the Democrat or Republican nomination is not a good person, and they're not good for the country, and they're not good for the world. So, and then when Obama was president, all anti-war activism practically came to a stop,
right?
Because, you know, he was a Democrat, so we can't oppose the Democrat.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for that. Let me thank our guests for their contribution, Cindy Sheehan, alternative political activist, and Christina Tobin, a founder of the Free and Equal Elections Foundation. Elsewhere, COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc across Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting large numbers of daily cases and deaths. In France, officials registered over 270 coronavirus deaths in 24 hours, taking the total to over 40,400. Authorities there also reported a total of more than 1,787,000 infection cases, up by some 39,000 since Saturday. Meanwhile, a total of over 41,000 people have now died of the virus in Italy, which has registered over 935,000 infections. In the UK, over 20,000 cases were reported, taking the total to more than 1.1 million. The first wave of the disease took a heavy toll on European countries and their economies, but now, following the resurgence of the virus, the EU is grappling with the second wave. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States is the worst affected nation in the world by COVID-19, with more than 10.2 million confirmed cases and a death toll of more than 243,000. The country's coronavirus outbreak was a key policy battleground in the run-up to the November 3rd election and contributed to a surge in postal and early in-person voting. Also, the second coronavirus wave has plowed on relentlessly throughout Europe, which reported more than 12 million cases and about 301,000 deaths as swathes of Italy returned to lockdown and the British city of Liverpool trialled citywide testing on Saturday. According to an Agence France-Presse tally of health authority figures, the continent has become the new epicentre of the pandemic and a total of 301,000 deaths have been reported in Europe since the COVID-19 virus first hit. Two-thirds of these fatalities have been registered in the United Kingdom, Italy, France, Spain, and Russia. We now present you a report written by staff writers of the Financial Times, as well as Agence France-Presse under the heading, US hits record daily coronavirus case rise 3 days running. Europe deaths exceed 300,000. Please stay with us for more. According to Johns Hopkins University, the United States reported a third straight daily record of new coronavirus cases on Saturday, whilst Europe's death toll surpassed 301,000. More than 127,000 infections were reported in 24 hours, as well as about 1,160 deaths. The news comes as officials announced that White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had tested positive for the coronavirus. He's the latest official in the U.S. administration of Donald Trump to contract the disease. The U.S. is the worst affected nation in the world by COVID-19, with more than 10.2 million confirmed cases and a death toll of more than 243,000. It was not immediately clear how Mark Meadows, who has often appeared at public events without wearing a face mask, was infected. According to the New York Times, he first tested positive on Wednesday. The New York Times said Trump's election campaign advisor, Nick Traynor, also has tested positive for the virus. Mark Meadows traveled with the president on the final days of campaigning and was an election night party attended by dozens of Trump supporters at the White House. The country's coronavirus outbreak was a key policy battleground in the run-up to the November 3rd presidential election and contributed to a surge in postal and early in-person voting. In late October, Mark Meadows said in an interview with CNN that the United States was not going to control the pandemic, saying that COVID-19 could only be defeated by mitigation areas like vaccines and therapeutics. Donald Trump and his wife Melania and son Barron all contracted and recovered from COVID-19, as did the National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, the senior advisor Stephen Miller, and the White House counselor Hope Hicks. A ceremony at the White House on 26th of September came into focus after the president contracted the virus. More than a dozen reporters, guests, and officials at the crowded Rose Garden event, where Donald Trump formally announced Amy Coney Barrett as his pick for the Supreme Court, contracted the virus. Video footage captured attendees standing close together without wearing face masks. Some shook hands, bumped fists, and even hugged. Second coronavirus wave has plowed on relentlessly throughout Europe, which reported more than 12 million cases and about 301,000 deaths, as swathes of Italy returned to lockdown and the very city of Liverpool trialed citywide testing on Saturday. According to an Agence France-Presse tally of health authority figures, the European continent has become the new epicenter of the pandemic, and a total of 301,000 deaths have been reported in Europe since the COVID-19 virus first hit. Two-thirds of these fatalities have been registered in the United Kingdom, Italy, France, Spain, and Russia. As countries race to try to curb their spiking cases, they impose new lockdowns despite signs of growing unrest, with several Italian regions shutting down and Greeks facing fresh stay-at-home orders from Saturday. In Italy, a lockdown was ordered for prosperous Lombardy region, fellow northern regions Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, as well as one southern region Calabria. Giorgio Gori, the mayor of the northern city of Bergamo, the epicenter of Italy's coronavirus crisis earlier this year, said, "There is more tiredness and more distrust around than during the first lockdown, after people protested outside his home." The head of the infectious diseases department at Milan's renowned Luigi Sacco Hospital, Massimo Galli, told reporters he was alarmed by the situation and had been ever since the end of Italy's first lockdown in May. Massimo Galli said, "I've always confirmed that you have to keep on high alert to avoid the return of problems," he added. "I'm sick of saying the same thing again, like the voice screaming in the desert without any acknowledgement." Governments are desperately trying to find alternatives to lockdowns, which hammer the economy. In England, which has also shut down, the northwestern city of Liverpool on Friday began the country's first citywide coronavirus testing program. All 500,000 residents will be offered repeat tests, even if asymptomatic, under a pilot scheme that could be rolled out nationwide if successful. British MPs have resoundingly voted to support Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan for a month lockdown, which began on Thursday, 5th of November. The government kept a rebellion by recalcitrant Conservative MPs at the House of Commons at bay to win by a staggering 516 votes to 38, a majority of 478. The vote means that as of Thursday, 5th of November, hotels, coffee shops, restaurants, non-essential shops have all closed across England and stay shut until 2nd of December. People also were told to stay at home, apart from when attending school, college, university, work, or to go shopping for food and other essential items. The latest lockdown effectively replaces the three-tier system of regional restrictions across England for 4 weeks, after which the tiers will be reimposed. Before the vote, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson counselled MPs that a second lockdown was required to contain the surge of COVID-19 cases. Johnson warned in dramatic style that, absent immediate action, Britain could expect deaths on its grievous scale, with hospitals in extraordinary trouble by as early as next month. During a three-hour debate in the House of Commons, Conservative rebels, in addition to a handful of Labour MPs from the northwest of England, tried to push back against the Prime Minister's plan, largely on economic and personal liberty grounds. Sir Graham Brady, the chair of the powerful 1922 Committee of Tory backbenchers, told the House of Commons he would vote against the lockdown with greater conviction than any other vote he had cast in his 23 years in Parliament. Sir Graham Brady claimed, "The thing that troubles me most is that the government is reaching too far into the private and family lives of our constituents." Former Prime Minister Theresa May opposed Boris Johnson's plan on the grounds that COVID-19 cases in Liverpool, a hotspot for the coronavirus infections, is supposedly falling. Theresa May's position was supported by former Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith, who questioned the data behind the Prime Minister's proposed second lockdown. Ian Duncan Smith was also critical of the appalling leak of the government's lockdown plan to the media before its official announcement. But despite the vociferous opposition from senior Conservatives, Boris Johnson remained resolute in the House of Commons, proclaiming that he's not prepared to take the risk with the lives of British people. The vote in the House of Commons took place on the day that a further 25,200 people tested positive for COVID-19 in the United Kingdom, accompanied by 500 confirmed coronavirus-related deaths. Meanwhile, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, has launched a stinging attack on the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, accusing him of underestimating the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Speaking at the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference on Monday, 2nd of November, Keir Starmer directly blamed Rishi Sunak for the severe economic cost of the late lockdown. Starmer proclaimed, "Make no mistake, the Chancellor's name is all over this." Keir Starmer added, "His decision to block a circuit breaker lockdown, to dismiss it as a blunt instrument, and to pretend that you can protect the economy without controlling the virus, will now mean that businesses have to close for longer, more people will lose their jobs, and the public finances will be worse than they need to be." The Labour leader urged the Chancellor to set out a full package of support, in keeping with what was offered during the first lockdown in spring, to ease the pain of shutting down the bulk of the economy. The Labour leader also used the occasion to address wider issues relating to the lockdown, including the protection of the country's core infrastructure. According to Keir Starmer, the four-week lockdown must be used to fix, test, trace and isolate, and to give control to local authorities, to get a grip on messaging and rebuild public trust, and to provide a clear and transparent roadmap to protect businesses and the National Health Service over the months to come. Starmer's stinging attack on Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the government was all the more striking as Prime Minister Boris Johnson dropped out of speaking at the same event, the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference. Instead, Business Secretary Alok Sharma addressed the CBI audience and admitted that a fully functioning vaccine may never materialize. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Europe, Denmark defended the strict measures it has imposed on the northwest of the country after a mutated version of the new coronavirus linked to mink farms was found in humans. Copenhagen has warned that the mutation could threaten the effectiveness of any future vaccine and has ordered the slaughter of all of the country's minks, estimated at up to 17 million. Danish Foreign Minister Jeppe Kofod said, "These are timely and necessary measures amid a worrying development." Meanwhile, Greece's second nationwide shutdown drew the ire of teachers as it closes down secondary schools and universities. Theodoros Souchlos, the president of the Secondary School Teachers Union, said many high school students had already fallen behind during the first wave of the virus. He added the second lockdown could raise inequalities further, as some students don't have access to Wi-Fi or own a laptop, or else it is used by parents for teleworking. He said these are issues that the government should have prepared for during the summer, but instead it acted as if everything was under control. People rushed to get a haircut before the Saturday shutdown, even though hairdressers are allowed to open for 2 more days. The coronavirus has been mercilessly hitting Switzerland, and in particular its French-speaking region, where hospitals are rapidly becoming overwhelmed. At one small hospital, patients with severe COVID-19 infections filled all 10 enclosed beds. The pandemic has killed at least 1,256,000 people since it first emerged in China late last year, out of more than 50.3 million confirmed infections. Data shows economic growth slowing down in Britain, particularly in the services sector last month. The UK economy is headed for a double-dip recession this winter. According to the latest IHS Market CIPS monthly survey of the services sector, which is equal to 3/4 of economic activity, a recovery over the summer stalled in October increased additional pressure on the Bank of England to improve its stimulus programme when officials met on Thursday, 5th of November. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee's meeting considered a big injection of funds to support the economy. Whilst this was regarded as an unlikely prospect only a few weeks ago, most city analysts have projected a £100 billion rise in quantitative easing, where the Bank of England injects money into the economy by acquiring government debt from financial institutions. IHS Market says several months of declining consumer confidence in Britain, which has tracked the increase in the number of coronavirus cases, decreased demand for hotels and restaurants, whilst the government's policy of tiered lockdowns effectively stopped the return to the office across much of the country. The Purchasing Managers Index PMI for the services sector, which includes industries ranging from retail to hospitality and financial services, fell to 51.4 in October from 56.1 in September, to come in below the consensus reach among city analysts and an earlier flash estimate of 52.3. The composite Purchasing Managers Index PMI, which encompasses the manufacturing sector, dropped to 52.1 from 56.5 in September. IHS Economics Director Tim Moore said the data collected between 12th and 28th of October, before the second nationwide lockdown was imposed, showed the economy seems on course for a double-dip recession this winter and a far more challenging path to economic recovery next year in 2021. Two successive quarters of negative growth, which happened in the first 6 months of 2020, equals a recession, with the term double-dip, which is used to describe two downturns in quick succession. The Purchasing Managers Index report said employment across the services sector decreased for the 8th consecutive month, whereas customer-facing service providers, especially those in hotels, restaurants and catering establishments, faced a slump. New orders declined for the first time since June. Tim Moore said a lack of forward bookings in parts of the economy most affected by lockdown measures led to widespread reports of redundancies and another sharp fall in the total employment numbers during October. Samuel Toombs, the chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said markets survey suggests the recovery essentially ground to a halt in October. Samuel Toombs said the effect would be disclosed in lower gross domestic product growth, which would stay around 8% below its pre-COVID peak at the end of the year. Samuel Toombs, the chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said October was a turning point on several fronts, asserting that a dramatic fall in the use of public and private transport and a drop in demand for discretionary consumer services contributed to a wider shutdown.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan. She is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me, inshallah.
We are very happy that
we'll discuss the principles in a manner that parents get convinced.
Inshallah. So, in our previous program, we talked about justice towards our children, and you gave us some very important points on how to administer justice and the effects that come about, some of which were, if we are just to our child, then the child will be just to himself and to people around him, and it will prevent envy to come into his heart.
Yes.
So you are going to tell us more.
Last but not least, one of the other effects that I'd like to say is that the child will be brought up from the very beginning of his life with this spirit of being fair and having a behavior of fairness in him. And this will provide a very good ground for social justice in him. Like justice everywhere he goes, you know. Like for example, when he goes in parks, if a person is, you know, with him, you know, in a narrow street,
he'll
give way to him because maybe he's old or something like that. Any matter, if you go in regard, you know, like for example, in a bread shop, If somebody came first, however much he's in a hurry, he'll stand in the line.
Yeah.
All these things project how much justice is inculcated in you. So this behavior is very important. We can also test ourselves if we have this justice right now. What encounterances do we have, and how just are we to that encounter? Do we just jump to conclusions, or do we give a chance to the people to probably, you know, give their say in matters? For example, home, you know, like if our husbands got late, do we just pounce on them and say that, what happened? You're late, this, that, or wait for him to explain, for example.
Definitely.
This is just behavior, seeing his situation. And in every way, of course, it starts from the home. That's why I mentioned this husband-wife matter.
Yeah.
But if you go and see, then it projects to the children.
It definitely needs patience.
It definitely does need patience. So justice, the ingredient of justice is patience, right?
Yes.
One of the ingredient is patience. So injustice and discriminatory treatment of the children not only deprives the parents from their love, but it also endangers the future of the child. And this is why scholars of education and upbringing in the present era have considered the observing of justice in treating children necessary for the upbringing of virtuous people, a virtuous society, a virtuous family.
Very
in future.
Yeah.
When you get a son or a daughter married, then that child will have this justice, and that will take it forward to his or her own family. And Islam emphasized this matter 14 centuries ago, when the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam used to order the Muslims to observe justice not only in granting material things like gifts, but also, very interestingly, kissing the children.
Mm.
It's so important, yeah?
Yeah.
That he used to not bear it if one father kissed one child but left the others.
Yes.
Share it equally. Showing your concern, showing your affection, share it equally. So it is evident that fair behavior does not mean equal and similar behavior.
Okay.
It means having astuteness in you that whatever allocation and whatever right is allocated to a certain person in a certain quality and quantity.
Okay.
So it, many times it happens that observing justice requires that the father interacts more with some of his children because of the differences in the talents, or due to a sickness they have, or due to the age or other issues. Okay. This is not considered as injustice. And in these cases, he must explain the reasons for his treatment to the other children. So you see, if you have a sick child at home, for example, a handicapped child, that child is always at home. He can't go out anywhere. Then you have another child running and, you know, playing football and going out and here and there with his friends.
Yeah.
And then you kiss the child and you spend more time and talk to him. So the other child has to be informed that, look, you are not in his place.
Yeah.
I'm giving the right position to him.
Very
the
true.
Place where you require friendship, love, affection to be told and to be reiterated time and again, right?
Yeah. But I think to also know all of this, the parents have to do a lot of reading and researching so as to know how to be balanced and how to be just in the correct way, in the
Absolutely.
Right manner.
And it comes so naturally,
yeah.
But they have to know to remain steadfast.
Okay. So inshallah, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back after the break. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The show is Islamic Upbringing with our dear sister Salma Khalfan, who has been telling us about administering justice with our children and its importance. So what you mentioned was that injustice also endangers the future of the child, and therefore it's very crucial for us to be careful in how we are, you know, with our children. And that fair behavior is basically allocating justice and allocating their needs in the right quantity, in the right quality, in the right time. So you're going to tell us more about that.
Yeah, actually it's not a bad idea to point out a tradition here that, you know, when the parents feel that observing the rights of the children brings about some negative or dangerous effects. Observing the rites here you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's very, very like intricate and subtle. Have you noticed?
Very
because
true.
Observing the rites shows their affection and love. But here, there's a tradition we have that it, if he feels or she feels that there's some negative or dangerous consequences, then he should stop observing their rites also. Considering the other children present there, the siblings. Like I had mentioned just a while back that, you know, when you see a child with basic needs, like who is, for example, handicapped child at home, then you have to give him more attention so that he cannot become more depressed, right? Mm-hmm. And you see another child, the sibling, maybe he's so, you know, hale and hearty, doing everything he wants to because he is, like, healthy.
Yeah.
So you have to give that other one who doesn't feel neglected, right? So here, that's exactly what we have a tradition that states this kind of attitude that Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam says, my father, Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam said, by Allah, I act with one of my children and make him sit on my knees, show him much affection and thank him a lot, even though my other child is right. But I do it for the sake of protecting him from that child and from others, so that they may not do the same thing against him as the brothers of Yusuf done to him. Allah did not send down the chapter of Yusuf other than to be an example, so that some of us do not feel envy towards others as Yusuf's brothers envied and wronged him.
Mm.
So that envy, enviousness doesn't come. If he wouldn't thank the child enough, take him in his knees, the other child would feel envious of the other child. See?
Mm-hmm.
And he knows, a father and mother know the attitude of the children. They all have different kind of feelings and you know, like thoughts, right? So, the Imam, of course, knowing that this child wouldn't mind, takes that child who would be envious of the other child and gives
him
so much showering love so that he cannot envy.
But then, like, also with the children of nowadays, we feel a bit worried that if we do show that one love, then and affection, and the other one will think, oh, so what he did was correct, or he himself, the child, will think what he did was correct, so, you know.
And that's why the scholar writes that you have to explain them also
sometimes.
Mm. And if need be, for example, if need be, then you have to explain them. But of course, this kind of actions don't happen often, okay? Sometimes when you know that there's a threat of a certain sibling envying another sibling, then you should give him love, of course. Maybe you can do it in a subtle way, like in privacy or something, to reassure him. Or maybe you can speak to them in such a way that they know that what is, you know, what behavior is coming from the parents towards them.
Yes, that's very true. So thank you very much. We're just going to take a short break, and after the break, we're going to continue this discussion. Stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, be just between your children when giving something.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So, Sister Salma, you were telling us about a very beautiful tradition, and it made us realize that sometimes when we feel like one child is, you know, who did the wrong thing, we feel like, okay, we're going to punish him, we're just going to put him in the corner, and, you know, it's important for us to show that child very much love and affection and try and explain him so that he doesn't feel that, you know, he's... you know, or he'll feel envious for the other with the other child, and so it's very crucial for us to be very careful, you know, on how we're going to deal with those kind of children. And you are going to tell us more.
Yeah, I was just thinking that it would be such a great task. I mean, it would be such a wonderful thing to apply this when a teacher is teaching her students,
mm-hmm.
or when a preacher goes to preach in the mosque.
Yeah.
You know, administering this justice, giving everybody the respect that they deserve. Not that the people who are sitting in the front and the people who paid for example, the organization of the majlis should be given allocated special respect. No. they should be given that kind of respect in order to administer this justice that, look, all of us are important to this teacher.
Yeah.
And in fact, the way this hadith mentioned, as mentioned Imam Baqir alayhi salam, in order to prevent the envy of some of his children to each other and its evil results, not only showed affection to the child, whom he must be affectionate more to than the others, but he also showed affection to the other child who was jealous. And in this way, he protects the favored child from the danger of his brother's jealousy. And this is an important aspect, you know, when you upbring a society, when you upbring a school, you are laying that foundation. So, you know, to give attention to the people who are very naughty and create trouble, sometimes is a very good thing.
Yeah.
You know, the people who are out to seek vengeance, so that not to spread this jealousy. Or sometimes it even happens in such a way that a person is so clever in his class. So you don't have to show it off that this person is the only clever one in IP. But you should.
Yeah, it usually happens.
Yeah. See? So that's how this vengeance and this hatred and this jealousy and all this, you know, creeps about.
Yeah.
So we want to prevent the society. And I guess, well, inshallah, with the help of Almighty Allah, if we raise children like that who are going to become leaders, they might be a leader of a foundation, they might be a leader of a school, they might be leader of communities, they should put this in mind.
Yeah, inshallah.
And you know, such a thing goes a long way. Done with sincerity, it goes a long way. We shouldn't underestimate this. Just that heart should be there, that you should do it sincerely for the sake of Almighty Allah, then the results are, of course, evident.
Definitely. I wish there was a way we could, like, spread the word and, you know, make
and everyone understand this. This is why we are in radio just now, right?
Definitely.
Inshallah, that the audience may take this seriously and really regard and the justice in themselves. Are you being just to yourself?
Mm.
This is very important. Give yourself your needs, spiritual needs, physical needs. Give yourself that. In a way that you don't under-eat. When you have to look after a child, you don't have to say that I forgot my food, my meal. No,
yeah.
You have to. Or I don't have time to recite this and this dua or pray namaz. No, that's wrong.
Yeah.
You have to pray your prayers on time. You need that food, spiritual food.
So we just have to try and be balanced in all ways.
Exactly. Yeah.
Inshallah. So thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Inshallah.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.